June 23rd, 2016, in Harrow, United Kingdom, and we're going to be looking at four keys to training your children or anybody in the culture of Krishna consciousness. So you'll see as we go through this that it's not just applicable for children, although we're going to be focusing on children. All of you have children? You all parents? We're going to be focusing on children, but just see that these principles are certainly applicable to everyone. If it's possible for people to sit so that your backs are not directly to the deities, I don't know if that's possible or not, but if that is possible, that would be good. We have some room over here. People can sit over here. So we have until what time?
Maybe 8:30, 8:45.
Okay. So I usually actually teach this with a flip chart or a board or something. So I'd like to first ask, how did you learn, when you were growing up, how did you learn what was the proper culture and behavior? What was the process?
By observing others.
Okay, by observing.
Or by observing parents as well.
Observing others and parents. What
yeah. But following the example of
following
my parents and...
Mm-hmm.
What was your question, sorry? How did I learn?
Yeah, how did you learn what was the proper culture and behavior when you were growing up? I'm going to go around more than once with this group. So.
When I joined the temple...
No, when you were a child.
The example of my parents.
They already said that. You're going to have to think of another one.
Teachers.
I didn't say that wasn't the truth, but there's more than that.
Friends. Peers.
From your peers, okay. And
by reading also.
By reading, okay, very nice.
Telling.
Okay, from the parents' direct instruction. Okay.
Also from the media.
From the media. Okay.
Mm-hmm. By observing other people as well.
You already said so.
School is also.
They already said that. So what about school? She said teachers and peers. Something else from school?
Education.
Well, education is way too vague. That doesn't mean a thing. Yeah.
Sort of experimentation and playing and making mistakes and.
How did you know they were mistakes?
Did you get hurt? You learn not to do that again.
Detention.
You get in trouble. You get punishment. I guess.
Actually, I didn't have much of a culture.
Everybody has a culture. You may have a demoniac culture, but everybody has a culture. It's not possible to have human society without... By culture, we don't mean a good culture. We just mean any... What are the norms of a society? What are the values? What are the proper behaviors? How do we act? So every group of human society has some sort of a culture. It may not be a nice culture. And every human society has ways of teaching this culture to their children. So can you think of any ways that you learned your parents' culture and the culture of the surrounding...
By going to the temple.
Okay. I'm still asking you. Anything? Nothing else? Anybody else?
Some of the cultures that like intuition, you do things just from your own intellect, without example.
Well, how is that learning the culture that's around you?
Just your own thoughts that make you do things.
But how is that? I don't understand how that's a way that you're learning your surrounding culture and the culture of your community. And your family. Maybe you can explain it to me a little better. Anybody else? Okay, so we've heard from other people's examples. We've heard about the examples of parents and teachers and others. We've heard from your direct instruction, from experimenting and getting into trouble, from books, from media. Did I miss anything? Going to the temple, getting attending programs at the temple. Anything else? There's more than that. Anybody can think of anything else?
Yes, when I was younger, going to the church instead of temple.
Right.
Yeah.
So what was it at a church or a temple that helped you learn culture?
Maybe some rituals and some etiquette.
Okay, but did they teach you directly or you just observed it?
Observing.
Anything else happened at churches and temples?
I think if you talk somehow.
Okay, so there's direct instruction.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's interesting that we tend to think that we pick up the culture of our family and society primarily through example and direct instruction. And that was the main thing I was hearing from all of you. But I'll tell you quite frankly, that's not the main way that we learn culture. That was the main way that children learn culture a very long time ago. Because if you think about it, in modern society, and if you're going back even several decades, there's so many examples. The examples of your teachers may not match that of your parents, your peers may not match that of your parents and teachers. And what to speak of the examples in the media that may not match anything that's going on in your house. And then just examples in society in general, unless you live in a very isolated life. So human beings used to live in somewhat cultural isolation. People didn't travel much. I mean, when I was a very young child, one of my sisters married a foreigner, and we went over the Atlantic in a propeller plane. My grandmother crossed the Atlantic in a boat, not because she wanted to take a cruise. There weren't jet planes when I was little. And when my sister was living overseas, we had no way to call her. There were no transatlantic cables to call her. And letters would take a month, at least. The way we communicated, my father bought a huge tape recorder, this big, as big as like a laptop, a backpack case today, and bought her an identical one. And we would make a recording of ourselves talking to her, and then we would mail it overseas, and of course it would take a month to get this. And she would listen to our recording, and she'd make another recording and send it back. And people just simply didn't travel that much. They didn't travel that much, they didn't have that much experience with other cultures. The news that you saw, any international news, was at least a week or two old. Again, they were making a film and then they were mailing it. And it wasn't like these, you couldn't do an overnight shipment. You couldn't do an overnight mail from America to Europe. It just wasn't time. So people were very isolated. And especially people in rural areas were extremely isolated from other cultures and other examples. And so, pretty much, unless you lived in a very big city like London, Tokyo or New York or something like that, you pretty much saw consistent examples. Your parents, your friends' parents, your grandparents, your aunties and uncles, and everybody's aunties and uncles and grandparents pretty much behaved in a similar way. And if they weren't, they were ostracized from the community. And there was some meaning to that. I mean, today, if you live in London, it doesn't mean much. What does exile mean? You just move a block away or something. It doesn't have any meaning. But before people used to travel a lot, communities were tighter, it meant a lot. And you didn't see other examples. You had a local school, and the school was pretty much teaching the same culture as the home. Am I correct? It was like that? There wasn't much media. I mean, when I was a young child, there were four television stations in New York City, all of which were black and white, all of which were just live programming a few hours a day. There just simply wasn't access to a lot of other examples. So that was it. I mean, you just saw what everybody else was doing, and then there'd be some direct instruction. You should behave like this, you should behave like that. was pretty much enough. And the majority of people followed the culture of their families because that's what they were exposed to. They simply weren't exposed to something else. It was only if somebody maybe went off in the military or went off, you know, as a traveling merchant or, you know, something odd where they'd really be exposed to something outside of their community. And so for a long, long time in human society, other things were not so necessary. Although these other four things we're talking about have been operating since the beginning of human society as well. But nowadays, I don't see that you can rely that much on example and direct instruction. I really don't. I think that our children are exposed to many, many different kinds of examples, even within our own communities. You know, our own communities tend to be more diverse in many respects, yes? People tend to be from diverse regions and diverse varieties of culture, even within our particular culture. People have many different ways of behaving. I mean, even I've been in devotee communities where, you know, people have different, they're devotees, but they have different standards for what they eat, for example. And this was true even 30 years ago. Different standards for what they consider appropriate entertainment. Again, this was true even 30 years ago, and it's even more true now. That you're thinking, well, they're a devotee. You know, I can send my kid to their house and, you know, you find out that they've been watching something you wouldn't have shown them and they were eating things you wouldn't have fed them. You understand? So there's this variety of examples that are going on. What to speak of if they go to a regular school and all the different families there and everything they're seeing there. And good luck trying to keep your kids away from the media. I mean, I used to say a long time ago, yeah, it was very simple. The way you kept your kids away from the media is you found that, we call it the idiot box. Mm-hmm. You find the idiot box, you go to the back, you find the wire, you follow it to the wall, you pull it out, and you take the thing to a window and throw it out of it. And that was the end of that. But that doesn't work anymore. It doesn't work anymore. Practically all the kids have, you know, a little thing in their pocket. Yes? Mm-hmm. Practically everyone. Where they can... You know, they can be exposed to anything and everything, and they are exposed to anything and everything, and you've got to assume, I mean, you really need to assume, that by the time a kid's 14, that they've seen pretty much everything there is to see. They've seen and heard about things that I don't even know about. I mean, seriously, that I don't even know about. I don't even know what it is. I don't even know people do that. If you told me people do that, I'd go, really? But the kids have seen it. You can assume that they have. Even if you're very strict in your own home, they'll see it sometimes. Or something like that. So they're seeing a wide, wide variety of examples. What would you say? And why would they pick necessarily the examples of their parents? They might not. So relying on that in 2016 is not very smart. And then we're saying direct instruction. Right? But there's plenty of them. But frankly, most of us do not follow codes of behavior and culture very well just from direct instruction. You know, if direct instruction was the main way that people followed culture and behaved, we wouldn't have very many problems in human society because there's lots and lots and lots of direct instruction. Tell the truth, right? Control your sexual desires, right? This is being taught in practically every human society, but you don't see that that's particularly... It's helpful. It's something. It's not that it shouldn't be done at all. Maybe you could move up a little bit. But to rely on that alone, and if we think about that for ourselves, how do we respond to direct instruction? Anybody here getting really, you know, changed up in life just because of direct instruction? Sometimes. But generally? Bless you. So we just say to people, you know, don't look at anything nonsense. Is that going to be enough? No. It isn't. It just isn't. You know, it makes you feel guilty. Bless you. So it makes you feel guilty. It makes you feel like you want to hide what you're doing. But it doesn't really change your behavior. Occasionally. occasionally we received some sort of direct instruction that just inspires us. Yes, I want to do that. But that's the exception. And we can remember those, right? I can remember the instances in my life when a direct instruction changed my life. So if direct instruction generally changed my life, those wouldn't stand out like that. Yeah. Less than 10, I can hear less than 10 instances for someone's tumor, just direct instruction. And usually in those cases, it was someone I asked that I really wanted to know. So we're going to look at four ways that human society has used to train people in a culture and or change people's culture that are extremely, extremely effective. They're so effective that even one of these is enough to train someone in a culture. And they're far, far, far more effective than just example and direct instruction. Examples certainly should be there. If you don't have a good example, a lot of these won't work very well. But also nobody has a perfect example. Any of you a perfect example? I mean, we're human beings. We're fallible, we're conditioned. Even the liberated souls and the great devotees sometimes have examples that are a little confusing. Isn't it? Some of the stories in the Shastras about even the great devotees are, well, why did they do that? Haven't you thought that one? And we have to have some explanation from the Acharyas. Well, they did that because. They did that because of Yogamaya. They did that for this thing. Right? Am I correct? Yeah? You just look at the example, it's going to be confusing. Why does Ram send his pregnant wife off to the forest? Because one citizen is complaining. Is that the kind of example we want everybody to follow? So it's more complex, even if you're talking about God, even if you're talking about perfect persons. All right, so the first one that we're going to look at is love and trust. Love and trust. So this is, of course, something that Srila Prabhupada said that we should have in our Hare Krishna movement. So many of you said that you felt that you were influenced by parents, teachers, and friends. And I know in my own life, my father was a very significant influence. When I got Gayatri Diksha from Srila Prabhupada, my father handed Srila Prabhupada a check for life membership at the same time. And Prabhupada said, good father, good daughter. Mm-hmm. So it's a very, very sweet moment with Srila Prabhupada. But my father wasn't just my father. Biologically, it wasn't just he was in the house and that he earned the living, and he did all that. But my father, from the time I was about 2 years old until I moved out of the house to go to university, would spend about 2 hours with me every single morning. And he used to wake up at 5 in the morning, and he'd wake me up about 5:15, 5:30. And he would be with me until I went to school or he went to work, whichever one came first. And my mother had a habit of staying up until very late at night watching TV. My father wasn't a TV person. And then she wouldn't wake up until maybe 10 or 11 in the morning. It's definitely an effective alarm. You're taking a nap upstairs or whatever, you definitely answer the door. And what he would do with me in the morning, he would tell me stories. He would prepare my breakfast. I mean, my father didn't cook, but he would, you know, he would toast the bread, and he would make fresh orange juice. Why don't you move up again? One of the seven purposes of ISKCON is to bring the members closer to Krishna and closer to each other. So, and I'm not armed. They checked my bags at the Russian embassy, so you're safe. So he would make me breakfast, he would make fresh squeezed orange juice, he'd toast my bread, simple. I mean, it wasn't that he cooked anything. I don't think my father ever cooked anything in his life. But still, he would prepare my breakfast, and he would tell me stories, and he would play games with me. I mean, he was a CEO of a multinational company. He was president of his temple, it wasn't a Hare Krishna temple. He was a busy person. But still, he took that time every morning just to be with me. I mean, I remember even he had a doll and I had a doll. They were both named Ginger. And they would talk, you know, he played with me. And his ginger doll would tell my ginger doll stories. And I remember making little books with photographs. He had one of those Polaroid cameras. where you could get the picture right away. You know? We would take pictures of things and we would develop them together. So I really felt that my father cared about me. I'm sure my mother cared about me too, but I didn't feel that so much from her. You know, my mother would take me out to museums and parks and theater and things like that. But my father spent time just being with me. And because of that, I very much wanted to please him and not displease him. So, for example, when I was growing up again, people smoked, and people smoked pretty much everywhere. And there wasn't warning on cigarette packs, and their cigarettes were advertised on television and so forth. And when I was very young, 3 or 4 years old, my father said, "Don't ever smoke." He said, "Don't ever smoke." He said, "If you ever smoke, I'll take you to the lung cancer ward of the hospital." This was before it was a solid fact that smoking causes cancer. And he said, "If that doesn't get you to stop, then you're going to have to leave the house." And, you know, when I was in secondary school, 90% of the kids smoked, but I didn't. Why? Because I loved my father, and I wanted to please him. It wasn't just his example. It wasn't just that he didn't smoke. But because there was a sense of love and trust. So why do we follow somebody? We follow somebody because we're convinced that they care about us. Right, that they have our best interest in mind, that they're not manipulating us in some way. And also we're convinced that they know what they're talking about. Those two things. That they have some expertise and that they care. Because if I care but I don't know what I'm talking about, I might mislead you with good intentions. And if I'm an expert but I don't care, I may use my knowledge to exploit you. But if you're convinced that I both know what I'm talking about and I care about you, then you're likely to follow. We are programmed like that to please somebody. That is the nature of the soul. You know, when you have animal trainers, when they can't use punishment with very young animals. The little baby animals will not respond to punishment. But they will try to please their masters. So the little puppy dog will try to please its human masters. But it has to grow up quite a bit before it can be taught to obey. And I think it's the same with all living entities. We can be trained to obey, but our natural inclination is to do something to try to please someone. So we naturally want to mold our character, our behavior, our culture to please those who love us and who we trust. And all we need is one person like that in our lives. Now, my dear friends, you don't get to be that person by having a title. So just the fact that you're the mother, or you're the father, or you're the temple president, or you're the teacher, or even that you're the guru, that doesn't make it. It really doesn't. You know, and again, we're in a society where it's very, very easy for people to have a culture that's radically different from their families. Am I correct? That was not true 100 years ago. If you decide to have a culture that was radically different from your parents 100 years ago, you would find it very difficult to function in society. But today, it's not a big deal at all. So just the fact that you're the father, just the fact that you're the mother, just the fact that you're the teacher, that's not going to be enough. And just the fact that you're setting an example. There needs to be that relationship of love and trust. Now, if you as the parents don't have that with your children, but some friend at school does, then guess what? They're going to mold themselves to that friend instead of to you. And sometimes this principle even works if you don't know the person. Sometimes it works where people mold themselves according to the values of some celebrity. They feel some kind of imagined love and trust relationship with that celebrity. It's really just all in their mind. But they think, well, let me dress and act and talk and eat and so forth in such a way that this famous person will be pleased with me. And that illusion is also created by the media, by the way. When people watch some shows over and over again, you know, repeating shows that repeat with the same actors taking the same roles, you have a sense that you know those people. You have a sense, you know, you have this illusion that they're your friends and that you can trust them. The newscasters are like that too. You see the same newscaster every night or whatever. And you get a sense, well, I can trust this person and I know them. Of course, you don't at all. It's all an illusion. And people will then copy those persons. They'll think, well, I want to act in such a way. And they'll often act in such a way not just to please the actual actors, but to please the characters that they're portraying, which is even more bizarre. Not only do you not really have a relationship with the actors, you certainly don't have a relationship with the character that the actor is playing. But you have a sense that you do. There's the box in your living room, right? And you have a sense that you're getting to know them and you care about what they do and you're following up their activities and so forth. And you may start to mold your life in that way. I mean, there's a lot of research showing that, you know, all it took was some movie star showing he wasn't wearing a t-shirt under his shirt and t-shirt sales drop. And a lot of how culture is changed intentionally is done through the media. I think it was in the 60s in America that seatbelts in cars first started to be mandated. And what did they do? I mean, there weren't even seatbelts in cars before that. And what they did was the government worked with the movie producers and said, make sure in the movies you show people putting seatbelts on. Interesting. The whole idea of don't drive while you're intoxicated. You know, that's a fairly new thing in human society, to be having this as a culture. And one of the ways that this was propagated was when the people in the campaign went to different movie producers and television producers and said, are you willing to give me 2 seconds in your show to change people's lives? And they said, sure, what do you want? They said, if you show people drinking, have one person say to the other, who's the designated driver? Get put that into the vocabulary of the people. But again, people follow that because they're thinking, oh, this person is my friend. This character is my friend. This actor is my friend. Otherwise, it wouldn't have that influence. So we see here that Srila probably has some nice quotes here. And Prabhupada says, why should the brahmachari follow the guru? Right, could somebody read that? Could you read that first quote?
Therefore, brahmachari means living under direction of guru, guru hitam. And guru hitam, how he can be simply thinking of benefiting the spiritual master. Unless that position comes, nobody can serve guru. It is not an artificial thing. The brahmachari, the disciple, must have genuine love for guru. Then he can be under his control. Otherwise, why one should be under the control of another person? Mm-hmm. Lecture Srimad Bhagavatam 7.12.1.18.
Can you read the next one?
Our society is like one big family and our relationship should be based on love and trust. Letters to Pindra, Los Angeles, 6 August 1970.
So it's interesting that Srila Prabhupada said the reason we follow the Guru is that we feel the Guru loves us and we love the Guru. It's not just like, okay, it's my Guru, I have to follow. That doesn't work for a long time. Does it? Doesn't work for me. Okay, so our first one is love and trust. What is the first one, everybody?
Love and trust.
Okay. Now, the second one is something that many of you mentioned. We were asking about how you learned culture when you were a child. And that was stories and media. And we talked about the media a little bit in terms of relationship. But stories are a very, very powerful way of learning culture. And various cultures have employed stories as a way of transmitting culture for thousands and thousands or millions and millions of years. Right? And if we think about it, what are our shastras? They're stories. The Bhagavad Gita, which is philosophy, is all in the context of a story, and a pretty amazing story. There's a fight between family members, right? Maybe some of you can sit on the chairs. You know, Arjuna's fighting against Bhishma. It's very dramatic, yes?
Yeah.
And if we look at the whole Mahabharata story with Draupadi's disrobing and the Pandavas getting exiled, it's a very, very dramatic and emotional story, very engaging story. And we think about the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam are stories within stories within stories. You have the sages at Nandasharanya, and you have Maharaj Bricket, who's going to die in a few days. Again, it's very dramatic. And then all the stories within, Vidura, who's kicked out of his home, and Aswatthama, and Kardama Muni. And there's not one speck of philosophy in the Bhagavatam that's outside the story. Am I correct? So we find a lot of the scripture is within stories. And often stories within stories within stories. And then we find the great preachers, like Narada Muni really likes to tell stories. And he tells a lot of metaphorical, fable type stories. Also, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati really liked to tell stories. I don't know if you've seen that book, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati's analogy type stories, metaphorical type stories. So this has been the way, and we have these nice quotes here. Maybe one of the gentlemen can read this in section 2.
Prabhupada, yes. In our childhood, we saw every village, every town. System was, still there are, practically closed now, that in the evening, in the village, everyone should assemble in a place to hear messages from Mahabharata, Ramayana, not Vedanta philosophy. Was discussed.
Okay, someone else could read the second one.
Mahapurana. Mahapurana means the science of Krishna is described in story form. This is called Purana. People better understand in stories, in history.
So why are stories so powerful? Well, one reason is that stories bypass our conscious resistance. And we will much better take instruction in a story than in a direct instruction. Right? So I'm sure all of us here are honest people. Yeah, we're all honest, no thieves here, I hope. But are we perfectly honest? Is there anybody here perfectly honest? No. So let's say I use direct instruction. I say, you know, this is not good. You really ought to be perfectly honest. Is that inspiring? No. It isn't. In fact, what he should be telling you, But if I tell you a story, you know, you all know the story. So there was a little boy who was guarding the sheep. You know this story? So he was out guarding the sheep. It's pretty boring guarding sheep. I mean, that's how people fall asleep. They meditate on sheep, right? It's kind of a boring job. So you're out there in the pastures guarding the sheep. And, you know, he wanted some excitement. So he runs in the village. There's a wolf! There's a wolf! There's a wolf! And they take their whatever they had, bows and arrows or guns or maybe or sticks, and they go out looking around, and they don't see any wolf prints, and they don't see any wolf poo, and you know, they're like, we don't see any wolf. Well, he was over there, you know, okay, well. Somehow we didn't catch him. And the boy thought, wow, that was exciting. And a few weeks go by, and you know, he's like falling asleep watching the sheep. And he thinks, oh, that was fun, I think I'll do it again. And he runs into the town, there's a wolf! And so they're a little bit more skeptical this time, but they still come out with all their weapons and they're looking around and no sign whatsoever of a wolf. And they say, you sure there was a wolf? Oh yeah, for sure, you know, he was growling and he was over there, and the sheep were all getting scared. And, you know, they don't see it in the marks on the ground, but, oh yeah, a wolf. And then about a month later he did it again and he went in. There's a wolf. This time only half the people came. And this time they really looked. And they said, no, I don't really know if there's a wolf. And a week later, a real wolf came and he ran into town. He said, there's a wolf. And nobody came and the wolf ate the sheep. Okay, what happened when I was telling the story? You are relaxed. You're smiling. If I say, be honest or people won't believe you, then you're going to go like this. And you're just like, everything just shuts down. Yeah? You just go, pow! Close the curtain, close the door, leave me alone. And when I tell you the story, and then you open the curtain and you open the door, because it's a story. That's not about me. It's about some boy with a wolf. Sheep. Of course it is about me. But it doesn't feel like it's about me. And immediately relax. I mean, even with brain studies, our brains go into alpha waves. And you can see it if you tell stories. You can see people. They relax. Smile. They're attentive. It's very rare that people will fall asleep if you're telling a good story. If you're just giving direct instruction philosophy, you know, people kind of pinching their ears. You ever done that? I've done that. Yeah, that's a wonderful philosophy, Paul. But it doesn't happen with stories. Very, very rare. So it bypasses this false ego resistance. It's not about me. It's about somebody else. And we just open ourselves up and just take it in. Another really interesting thing about stories is some of you may know that athletes not only prepare by going out and hitting the ball, but they also mentally go through. You know that? They'll just sit down, they'll mentally go through what they're going to do with the sport. And I think most of us do that in general. If we're going to do something, you know, we have a special meeting that day, we mentally rehearse, right? Yeah. What am I going to do? What am I going to say? Now, it's been studied with athletes that when they're mentally preparing, they're having about two-thirds of the muscle engagement that they would have if they were physically doing the activity. Isn't that interesting? And also it's been shown that when people hear, read, or watch stories, that their brains will respond as if, not entirely, but to a large extent, their brains and their muscles will respond as if they were doing the activities that they're hearing, watching, etc., or reading about. And I think we've also had this experience. You know, you're reading a story, you're hearing a story, you're watching a story, and when there's something excited, your heart starts beating faster, as if you're in that situation. So what happens whenever we hear, read, or see stories? We are practicing whatever the people in those stories are doing. So if the people in those stories are acting virtuously, if they're acting spiritually, we are practicing acting virtuously and spiritually. We are rehearsing that in the story along with the characters. So then when we're not hearing the stories, we're far more likely to act in the ways that we mentally rehearse. You can see also the power of negative stories. And entire cultures have been changed through stories. I mean, if you think about, say, abortion, which was illegal when I was young, everywhere in the world. So how did it become legal? It didn't become legal by people talking about what happens in an abortion and what an abortion is. As soon as people would talk about that, nobody would want anything to do with it. But they don't. They tell a story. Oh, there was this 13-year-old girl, and she got raped, and she knew what to do. She was ostracized by her community. What did she do? They tell this story, and you're like, yeah. It's so good that she was able to have an abortion and go on with her life. Yes, this is what happens. And the entire mentality of a culture can change. It can shift 180 degrees through stories. That's what happens. There's something else that I'm not going to talk about. You can figure out what it is. That's recently made a huge shift in the world. A tremendous shift from 10, 20 years ago in the way people think about it. And it was done, again, not through facts, but through stories. Here's Tom and Joe, and they're your neighbors, and they're nice guys, and he's a doctor, and he's a lawyer, and what's your problem? And here's their life, and this is what they do. And they're like, yeah. What's my problem? But it's done through stories. It's not done through facts, and it's not done through preaching. It's done through stories. When I was a kid, also, there was a big emphasis on science and technology. There wasn't the mood toward the environment that there is today. In fact, when I was 15, I participated in a demonstration in favor of environmentalism, and it was considered socially subversive. Well, because modern science and technology was going to save the world. It already was. I mean, we were spraying DDT and wiping out malaria. We were vaccinating everybody and wiping out polio and smallpox. And we were giving everybody antibiotics and wiping out all kinds of diseases with antibiotics. And we were creating synthetic food. It was supposed to be a wonderful thing. And we were using chemical pesticides and fertilizers to create a green revolution in the world. And pretty soon we were going to colonize the moon. No. By the time I was 10, at least we were going to colonize the moon. Seriously, I mean, that was what we were talking about. So to come out and say, hey, wait a minute, you know, you're destroying the earth, you're polluting the environment, was considered very antisocial and anti-progress. And the way that things have switched was through stories. Stories of the farm workers working with pesticides where their children were born deformed. And things like that. Stories about the birds that would die in the eggs because of DDT poison. And because of these stories, it's now gone to the other extreme. So the government is promoting environmentalism and ecological awareness. So my point is that you can change the values and behavior of an entire society through stories. Sometimes it's one movie. One movie. One TV show. I mean, another good example. I'm sorry, most of these are negative examples, but that's the problem with the progress of Kali Yuga. There was a television show started, I'm not sure, probably in late 60s or early 70s, about a single career woman who had a boyfriend, but she never married him in the show. The last show they had in the series, they said, now she's got to marry him. No, we don't want him. She was living in the big city, and working on her own, and having a career. And that TV show changed people's values. It changed people's behavior, it changed people's values. Because again, as people would watch it, they would feel they were living it. Stories are extremely powerful. Extremely powerful. And they go right past our conscious awareness. They go right past our defenses. We put up a lot of defenses. I mean, most of those are false ego defenses, but we put up a lot of defenses against direct instruction. We analyze it. Some of those are bad because, like, who are you to tell me what to do? But some of those are useful. The mind has this accepting, rejecting function. And if I hear facts and I hear direct instruction, in fact, our default value is to reject them. Isn't it? We become very skeptical. I don't know, should I believe that? Is that really true? Do I really have to do that? When we hear stories, that's just turned off. We're not really aware that we're being inculcated with certain value systems and certain cultures. And we just open ourselves up to it. So, stories. Therefore, Prabhupada talks about here, in the villages, how in the evening they would tell stories. Now, another reason we're so into stories is that Krishna is very into stories. What are lila? All of his lila are stories. He's participating in narratives and stories eternally. And he delights in them, and he likes hearing stories about himself and his devotees. Mahaprabhu would cry over stories of Dhruva Maharaj and Prahlad Maharaj. And the acharyas tell us in the spiritual world every night there's dramas of Krishna's pastimes. You know, Mother Yasoda's telling Krishna the story of Lord Ramachandra. And Lord Sangadeva, without realizing that that's her own son. So Krishna likes stories, likes being in them, and likes hearing them. And so that's our natural proclivity. So our second way of transmitting culture is stories. And remember, my father not only spent time with me in a mood of love and trust, but he also told me a lot of stories. I think that's disappearing from human society. You know, the parents sitting with the children and reading to them. Even reading is kind of disappearing. You know, it's a lot easier to just watch something. Isn't it? Right? You read, you have to work more. So this storytelling to our children. I mean, I know of some now adults whose parents had left Krishna consciousness, but when they moved away from a temple, didn't have anything to do with the devotees, weren't really doing any of the practices of Krishna consciousness, but for one thing. And the parents had made recordings of Krishna's lila and put them to song. It was done by the parents. And they would play those for their children, even though they really didn't have anything else to do with Krishna consciousness. And all four of their children have become serious devotees.
Amazing.
Basically, just from that. Just from hearing those stories about Krishna over and over again as they were growing up. So, first one is?
Love and trust.
Second is?
Stories.
All right, we're going to look at the third one here. So the third one is really about something that's peculiar to human beings, something that doesn't exist in the animal society. And that is that all of us want to do something that is meaningful. We want to do something that is fulfilling and satisfying and has some meaning. Now, how do we define meaning? If you want to talk about the ultimate perfection of Krishna consciousness, it would be that we awaken to our eternal form and personality, and we engage in that personality and form in the service of Krishna. Am I correct? Is that a good assessment of what we consider is ultimate perfection? I realize that I'm Krishna's cowherd boyfriend, or I'm Krishna's father, you know, if you're one of the elders, I like a father, or I'm one of Krishna's girlfriends, or I'm one of Krishna's flowers, or I'm one of Krishna's cows. We just realize who I am in relationship to Krishna. I was just hearing Prabhupada talk about this yesterday. The devotee understands, oh, I'm one of Krishna's cows. And that is our understanding of perfection. Now, even in this life, in this body, we were talking about this morning at Soho, we understand what is our temporary material nature. That's like I'm a Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra. You know, I'm a householder, I'm a renunciate. What is my nature? What is my proclivity? What is my identity, materially speaking? And then we take that and we use it for Krishna. Correct? So the ultimate spiritual perfection is I wake up to who I am and use that for Krishna. Who I am eternally, really. And in this world, I become aware of who I am in this world. What do I like? What do I don't like? What am I good at? What am I not good at? And I use that for Krishna. Am I correct? Yes? So this is the basic aspiration of every human being. To be fully who I am, connected with something bigger than myself. Where I'm using my talents and abilities and my nature to contribute to something that's greater than myself. And this is how human beings in general define meaning. There's a lot of psychological, sociological studies. One famous scholar, Mikhail Csikszentmihalyi, he did a study on what he called flow. When you're so absorbed in what you're doing, you basically enter into a kind of samadhi. You know, and you don't care about eating, you don't care about sleeping, you're just totally into what you're doing. Because it so much fits who you are. And it has some higher purpose. Another very famous book, Daniel Pink, about called Drive. He's talking about we want to have mastery and autonomy and purpose. That those are the main motivators. Something that I'm really good at, that has some purpose, it has some value beyond myself. So materially speaking, people cannot offer this in an ultimate sense. Because materially speaking, who I am is an illusion. So I'm also not going to be fully satisfied even with who I am materially. None of us, right? Anybody here fully satisfied with who you are materially? So it's not who I ultimately am, I'm not fully satisfied with it. And then what is this greater value that I can use it for? You know, I can use it to help feed starving children or something, but there's a limit as to how much you really feel that it has value. Somehow the world seems to go on with its problems. And somehow the world keeps spinning, and when you die, you know, people only care about it for a week or two, and everything goes on. And so there's a real sense on the material level that it's hard to find meaning in life. But we Hare Krishna devotees can offer our children and everyone something that is genuinely meaningful. Even if I'm acting according to my current false identity, and even if I'm doing things which on the material level are not going to endure. Right? No matter how beautifully you decorate your altar, these plants are going to die, and this building is going to crumble. But it has eternal benefit because it's in relationship with the eternal. And even though this is a temporary identity, it's still out of Krishna's energy, and I'm connecting Krishna's energy. There's some eternal, real value to what I'm doing. Now, the way we humans are programmed is anything that comes anywhere close to using who I really am for something that's greater than myself. You know, I'm going to dedicate myself to that because it's so satisfying. I mean, I find it fascinating that even materially speaking, even if you're an atheist or anything about God, if you're doing something that's your nature for a greater good, you're going to feel much more satisfied than if you're just doing something that's not your nature or it's something that's just for yourself. Somehow you're starting to touch something that has something to do with reality. Who I am for the greater good. You're getting somewhere close to something that's real. Mm-hmm. And whenever we're put in a situation like that, we feel gratitude and connection with that whole situation. And we will want to mold ourselves and our values, our culture, etc., to be like whatever society is doing that for us. any time that I feel, yes, this is who I am, this is where I belong, and what I'm doing is helping, is doing some good for others, then I'm going to want to do it. Let's look at Prabhupada's quotes here. Anybody like to read these? Yes? Number three.
If the children associate with the elders in a regular schedule of devotional practice, that is the best way to train.
Okay, someone want to read the next one? You? Yes?
Krishna has given everyone something extraordinary. And to serve Krishna with one's extraordinary talent means successful life.
Okay, and can you read the next one?
Our leaders shall be careful not to kill the spirit of enthusiastic service, which is individual and spontaneous and voluntary. They should try always to generate some atmosphere of fresh challenge to the devotees, so that they will agree enthusiastically to rise and meet it. That is the art of management, to draw out spontaneous loving spirit of sacrificing some energy for Krishna.
So that's exactly how we feel when we're rightly situated and we see that what we're doing makes a difference. That's what Prabhupada's describing here. Now, in traditional societies, children were engaged in meaningful service from a very young age. And they naturally want to do it. I was just talking to my oldest son, and he has a chore chart for his children, especially when it comes to prasadam. Who's going to cook? Who's going to get out the spoons and the plates? Who's going to clean up the utensils? You know, who's going to clean the kitchen afterwards? He has a whole chore chart. So he was just telling me that his son, who's almost 3 years old, he'll be three in a couple weeks, he said he's now on the chore chart. he can't even talk very well yet. And I said, you know, what do you have Pitamas do? And he says, well, you know, he likes to get out the utensils. And I said, but he can't even count very well. He said, well, somebody has to help him, you know. He said, and he loves taking out the compost, but someone has to go with him, but he really likes it. So this is natural. It's natural. You see this in young children, that they want to be helpful. They want to do something that is meaningful. Now, in our modern society, I must say, we are really messing this up. We're just making a complete, utter, devastating mess of this. We think that the only thing kids should do until they have their bachelor's degree or maybe their master's degree or maybe 10 PhDs is go to school. And they shouldn't do any meaningful service until they have finished getting all these degrees. They have to have a whole wall full of them before they can do anything meaningful, which means they're going to be at least 22 years old before they're going to do any meaningful service. That, my dear friends, is absurd. Also, doing meaningful service is one of the main ways you think of yourself as being a valued member of society. One of the main things kids want to do is grow up. And one of the markers of being grown up is that you're doing meaningful service. You know, if you don't give kids good ways to show that they're grown up, then they'll take other ways of showing that they're grown up. Smoking and drinking and illicit sex, which are all adult activities. They were showing that the tobacco companies were saying, well, we're not trying to advertise to children. We're not trying to get children involved in smoking. In fact, we even say in our advertisements, smoking is an adult behavior. Well, that's the best way to get kids to do it. All right. So Srila Prabhupada wanted the kids engaged in meaningful activities along with the result, with the adults, from a very, very young age. Now, again, we have a philosophy that kind of mitigates against this, where we say, no, all your time studying. School, and after-school tutoring, and more after-school tutoring, and more after-school tutoring, and this lesson, and that lesson, and this lesson, and that lesson. And maybe you have time to do a little 5 minutes of puja. Maybe. Maybe you have time, you know, to hear one Bhagavatam story and chant one round of japa, and you're very, very busy, fill your mind up with academic schedule. But my dear friends, our life is not only academic. And it's not so hard to be a materially successful person in the United Kingdom as it is in some other parts of the world. It's not such a dog-eat-dog rat race here. You can be a well-rounded human being. In fact, if you have practical work experience at a young age, you know what? That's just as impressive as having all those degrees. It really is. I mean, my oldest son got a job as a software engineer before he had even started his undergraduate degree. He already got a job as a software engineer. I mean, now he has his degree in computer science. But he didn't when he first got his job. Why? He was doing programming from the age of 11. And practical, real programs. When he was a teenager, he designed the Devanagari font that the DBT uses. And he was doing programming for the DBT as a teenager. And my other son was already a manager of an international company while he was in his undergraduate program. In fact, I think before. I think he only had one semester at university when he got that job. Why? Because he'd already had managerial experience in our Gurukula. And he had computer experience, I mean, again, from a very, very young age. He had started his own business when he was 7 years old. I mean, we were running a Gurukula, and, you know, my husband would help him. But he would get pencils and paper and erasers and stuff and sell that to the students. And then a little later after that, he was managing all the textbook sales, and we would give him a little commission. Then we would show videos every Sunday after the Sunday feast. This was before everybody had a big flat screen TV in their house. And we would show the Ramayana and Mahabharata videos. And when he was very little, he would just make fresh orange juice and put it in ice cube trays and put a stick in them and sell the popsicles. When he got a little older, he'd make cheesecake and pizza and things like that and sell to the devotees. And because of that, he was able to get a job. How old was he? Maybe 18. When he got a top 18, 19, he got a top managerial job. So, it's not just that you have this degree and everything. Now again, it's a stupid thing. But it's not just that. It's also experience. You know, I remember my oldest son saying to me, Mata, you know, I know more about programming than the people in my office with master's degrees. He said, because I started doing practical stuff when I was a kid. I visited a temple where all the teenage devotees wanted to get initiated. And they were all really serious devotees. They were going to outside schools. A lot of them, their parents who weren't, you know, strictly following, whatever. But the temple president engaged them all in practical service at the temple. It was the teenage devotees who were managing the whole garden. And they had responsibility. And they were the ones who were managing all the decorations for the festivals. It was their responsibility. And they felt, yes, I want to be part of this movement. I want to be part of this movement. Now, sometimes it's hard for parents to give kids meaningful service because you really see your kid as a kid. So sometimes it's good if they can do meaningful service with some of the other adults. And if they're doing adult-level work, the other adults will start treating them like an adult. I'm just telling you, it's so incredibly satisfying. So incredibly satisfying. It really makes them want to be part of the Hare Krishna movement. I'm inviting, as I generally travel and preach, I'm inviting my teenage grandchildren to travel with me if they want to. And one of the things that I insist on is that whatever temple we're in, they have to do 3 to 4 hours of service for that temple. They said, like, chanting japa? I said, no, service for the temple. I said, you can chant japa too, but that doesn't count. And I tell them, I said, look, the temple's giving us a place to stay and food to eat it. I'm doing service to the temple, but you can't just, you've got to do something too. They're providing for you also. So, of course, I don't tell them this, but the other reason I'm having them do that, not just to develop gratitude, but so they're going to feel that I'm part of this movement, that I have something valuable to offer in this movement, that people come up to them and say, wow, you're really good at this, you're really good at that. Plus, they're learning all kinds of skills. I have a grandson who got a $20,000 college scholarship because of his work on Indrajitna Swami's Polish tour. They wanted to see, are you doing volunteer work where you're learning some skills? And what do you think that does for? Wow, I've gotten this from the Hare Krishna movement. You know, the kids who went to our Gurukul, they told me all the time, they said, you know, Mother Emma, when I go out in the world, people say to me, wow, where did you go to secondary school? I remember we had twin sisters who at 15 were already second initiated. And at one point their guru said to me, Amula, is it possible to take them out of school for a month? I have a crisis in a temple. I need a temple president and a head pujari. They were 15. He said, could I send them for a month to be the temple president and the head pujari? So they got a bunch of schoolwork done, like double, triple time before they left. I said, you got to get all your schoolwork done. So they did that, and then they did some more double when they got back. And they went and were telling President Hinton and Charlie for it. What do you think that did to them as people? So, meaningful service. If we want our children to really be part of the International Society for Christian Consciousness, then we can't always be telling them to get out. And what I see, the main way that children are treated in our movement is to tell them to leave. Isn't it? Oh, they're making noise, take them out. Give them some program that's specially for them in another room. But, you know, God forbid they're going to do something with the adults. Have them go to Bhagavatam class over there, have them do this over there, have them do that over there. You know what? They should be doing things as prophets. Have them associate with the adults in the regulars as much as possible. As much as possible. And as young as possible. My own suggestion is that at least by age 11 and absolutely by age 14. And if you can do it younger, do it younger. But somewhere between 11 and 14. Have the kids engage in meaningful service. Meaningful service means it has some real value. It's not just busy work. You're not just making cutesy little posters of Lord Nisingadig that nobody cares about. You know, and I've seen that kind of thing done with kids, where the kids make some little something. And they come give some demonstration. This is my little craft project. I mean, that's okay. But I would like to ask you, how many of us as adults do cutesy little craft projects? Is that a meaningful adult activity? Is it? No. And the kids look at that and they know very well this is just something, some little plaything to keep me busy. They see it very differently if what they're doing is helping to decorate the temple for the festival. If they're making little craft exhibits that are actually going up in the temple room and are part of the exhibits and have to look good because they're part of the exhibit, that's very different than they just make some little thing and they get up and say, here's my, and I just saw this in two places in Los Angeles. Here's my project about Lord Ramachandra. And everyone is bored to death. But they're going, and nobody cares about this thing. It's just thrown in the trash. That's not meaningful service. Okay, to have them do some cutesy little thing about Lord Ramachandra, that's very nice. I'm not saying they shouldn't do that. But they should also do some meaningful service. Okay, so do something that's going to be used, that has practical value, that other people are going to look at and say, oh, wow, who did this? You know, who did this? Who did this? Okay? So, meaningful service. So the first one is?
Stories.
Meaningful service.
All right. So the fourth one now is a little tricky. It's a little tricky. And I found that all the dozens and dozens of times I've taught this, when I ask people at the beginning, how did you learn culture yourself as a child, it's very rare that anyone talks about this last one. This is something that we all know exists. We all know it's part of our lives. We all know it's something real. But we very, very rarely intentionally use it to transmit culture. It is, however, one of the most powerful ways of transmitting culture and values and having people be part of a community. So I'd like to ask all of you, how many of you have a certain smell that just emotionally transports you to a different place? How many of you have some smell that does that? Smell is the most common for people. What about a particular piece of music, particular song? Particular place, particular kind of food, right? So these are called triggers. Sometimes they're called anchors. So there's somehow we have made an association between some sensory input and an emotional state. They're linked. So as soon as we get that sensory input, that smell, that song, that place, that food, that person's face, that time of the day, then it just triggers an emotional state. Right? It's not that it just triggers a memory. It triggers an emotional state. And that can be either positive or negative. So I was talking about my father and how my father would spend time with me every morning. Well, that was early in the morning. Remember I said he'd wake up at 5? So when we were running a Gurukul, we insisted that the kids had to get up for Mangalarti. And I remember one of the teenagers telling me, you know, I don't like getting up early in the morning. And it was such a shock to me. I thought, how could anybody not like getting up early in the morning? I don't know, it sort of broke my paradigm that it was even possible not to like it in the morning. And in that moment, I realized that the main reason I liked getting up early in the morning was my father. Because for my entire childhood, from the time I was 2 until I was 17, I was getting up early, between 5 and 5:30, and spending that 2 hours with my father, who I just loved absolutely. It was such a sweet, affectionate relationship with my father. So there became an emotional connection for me between the early morning and that feeling of love and affection and feeling protected that I had with my father. So that was a repeated week experience. So that's one way triggers can be formed. An experience that repeats, it's not a very strong emotional, it's not a very dramatic emotional experience. But it's fairly consistent and it repeats over time. Then you can also have one very strong experience. So we had a mailbox that was down, we had a long driveway to go to the mailbox. At one point my kid said to me, Mata, why do you so much like to get the mail? And it was kind of annoying. You had to walk all the way down the driveway to pick up the post, you know, and then come back. I thought about it. Why do I like to get the mail? And I realized that when we were building our school, that one devotee had sent a donation of $35,000. And I had went to get the mail that day. At that time, it was just sort of random whoever got the mail. Hey, why did you go get the mail? Like taking out the rubbish or something. Anyway, that day somehow I'd gotten the mail, and I'd opened that envelope while I was standing at the mailbox. You know, open that envelope, oh my God, $35,000. Wow, that's going to pay for like a third of the construction. And so I had this very strong, positive emotional experience that was connected to the mailbox. And so I liked to get the mail. An example of the negative, so we lived in Detroit, and there was a large Indian community right across the border in Canada. So we would go to the Indian shops to get our basmati rice and things like that. So we would go over probably once every couple months to go shop over there. And one day my daughter, you know, I was going to go shopping there, and she was 7, I think. And she said she wanted to go with me. So we go over into Canada, and I get to the big shop, and she says, Mata, I don't want to come in with you. I'll just wait in the car. So I come back to the car, and she was hiding under the dashboard. What's the matter? She said, Mata, while you were in the store, there was some man walking around the parking lot. I think he was one of those bad men that kidnapped little children, and so I was hiding. And she told me for years afterward, if she'd hear the word Canada, she would feel afraid. That was one very strong negative experience. And of course, we have rules by Rupa Goswami that says don't chastise anyone in front of the deities. Now, I'm sure one of the reasons for that is that deities don't really want to hear you yelling at somebody. Just like sometimes when I travel, I stay in people's homes, and sometimes the husband and wife are having an argument in front of me. I remember with this one family, I said, you know, can you guys like please settle this? And they wouldn't settle it. Guess you want to enjoy some chivalrous, angry rasa here. And just close my door. So, yeah, maybe Krishna doesn't like it, but I think also it creates a negative trigger for that person. You know, if you're chastising them in the temple room in front of the deities, then it may set up some negative trigger for them in the temple room in front of the deities. You know, if you really embarrass somebody in the temple. And we've seen this with our children. You know, I know one, she's now in her 40s, who was raised in the movement, and she said, you know, Armila, I love kirtan. She said, I love everything about Krishna consciousness, but not japa. She said, I can't even touch japa beads. I said, why? She said, well, when I was in Gurukula, if we didn't chant exactly perfectly, we were hit. And she said, what happened was, is that whenever I think about chanting japa, or even see japa beads, or touch japa beads, she says, I flinch. So she got this strong trigger between japa and fear. I know many times when I teach this, people will come up to me and say, oh, this is my problem. I mean, some people, they had some heavy negative experience in a temple, and they don't want to go to the temple anymore. And it can be, again, repeated weak experiences or one strong experience. Now, triggers can be reprogrammed. That's possible. It's not always so easy, but it's possible. But we should be trying to create positive emotional experiences, in connection with Krishna consciousness. I mean, as a teacher, I saw this happen with certain subjects. You had a kid who came in that was traumatized about mathematics, for example. You know, I had a kid who was failing all of her math tests. She did great on all of her lessons, but she was failing all of her tests. And it turned out that her parents were yelling and screaming at her about her math grades. And so as soon as she'd see a math test, she would just freeze. So we were able to reprogram that, but it wasn't so easy. So, all right, if your kid hates math, you know, that's not going to be the end of the world, but if they hate Krishna consciousness, that's going to be the end of the world. So this is talking about all kinds of things. Talking about activities, places, times, right? So I tell people, you know, if you have a regular program of worship every day, that's not the time and the place to yell at your kid. If they're doing something wrong, at least take them out of that room. At least take them out of the room and yell them out of the room. Or wait till the program's over. Once I learned about this as a teacher, one thing that I did, it's kind of hard for me to demonstrate it right here. But so I had a whiteboard at the front of the classroom. I also had a whiteboard on the wall. And as a teacher, sometimes you have to do something to get the whole class to behave. Or a particular child to behave, you know. Hey, stop talking. Whatever. So once I figured this out, I thought, I don't want to mix discipline with teaching. So I started using the front of the room for only teaching. And if I had to discipline a kid, if I had to correct a kid, I would move to the side of the classroom. I'd move to a place where I would never go when I was teaching. And then I'd say, oh, you know, look, Jiva, would you please put the crayons away? This is not the time. You know, it's time for science class. Do that later. But I wouldn't say that from the front of the room. I'd walk to the side of the room. Of course, after doing that for a while, all I had to do was take one step toward that side of the room, and the kid who was misbehaving would generally behave. But I wanted to keep my teaching space clean. I didn't want the kids to associate being embarrassed, right, or being corrected, and I would like to be corrected, with whatever we were teaching. So it's positive emotional experiences. Positive emotional experiences. And every culture tries to teach their culture through positive emotional experiences. This is, as far as I can see, one of the main reasons for religious, cultural, and national festivals and holidays. They're trying to give you some really peak positive emotional experience that you're going to connect with patriotism, or you're going to connect with your religion, or you're going to connect with family. A lot of what we do, you know, birthday celebrations, anniversary celebrations, graduations, but they have other functions as well. But one of the functions that they have is trying to create, sometimes doesn't work, but trying to create these peak positive emotional experiences, some very strong positive emotional experience that you're going to connect with family. Or, you know, having family have a traditional meal together every night or once a week or something like that. Of course, if at your family meal everybody's yelling at each other, which happens in some cases, then it's going to have the opposite effect. You're going to think, I don't want anything to do with this family anymore. Does that make sense to you? Yeah. Your family? So, positive emotional experiences. Why don't we read some of these quotes here? Can you read the first one? Number four.
This knowledge is the king of education, the most secret of all secrets. It is the purest knowledge, and because it gives the perception of the self by realization, it is the perfection of religion. It is everlasting, and it is joyful.
Somebody else would like to read this. You can read that next one.
Encourage them to chant as much japa as possible. But there is no question of force or punishment. If there is need, you may shake your finger at them, but never physical punishment is allowed. Try as far as possible to discipline them with love and affection, so that they develop a taste for austerity of life and think it is great fun to serve Krishna in many ways.
Now, by the way, Prabhupada was not against physical punishment, absolutely. But here he's saying don't use any physical punishment at all when it comes to something like Java. You know, he was very, very, very heavy about that. You know, for Krishna conscious activities, don't use any kind of punishment. Okay, so positive emotional experiences. So what the first one is?
Love and trust, stories, meaningful service, positive emotional experience.
So just one of those is enough to train somebody in culture and in values and behavior. What to speak if you have all four of them. And just imagine if you don't have any of them. And you think, I'm going to bring up my children in this culture through example and direct instruction. So as you can see, obviously this does apply to more than just the children, but we were focusing on children. So it is already 8:44. So we have this brief time for questions, yes?
So what do we do if we passed the young age? So if they're over 17, 18 years old, do we just apply number 1 and 4?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think anyone's ever asked me that question before. I see that this applies even to adults. You know, that this applies also to the guest who comes to the temple. This applies even to the long-time senior devotee. This applies to everybody. If you want people to stay in Krishna consciousness and want to be a member of ISKCON, there should be relationships of love and trust. They should be hearing stories of Krishna and his devotees. And also what stories we tell about ISKCON, by the way. What stories do we tell each other about ISKCON devotees? You know, Giriraj Swami had that book about some departed Vaishnavas, many moons. We used to have our Sankirtan newsletter glorifying the Sankirtan heroes. You know, do we tell inspiring stories about ISKCON devotees, or do we tell depressing stories about ISKCON? Meaningful service. Everybody should be engaged in meaningful service according to their propensity. And we should make an effort that everyone has positive emotional experiences. So I don't think that these are by age. The kind of thing that you don't want to do after 16 is direct instruction. I think you want to do very little of it even before 16, and after 16, get rid of most of your direct instruction. I don't think it should be your method of choice at any age. I think it should be something rare. The others are much more effective. But after 16, pretty much forget it. You know, you really have until a kid's 16, probably said, to mold them. After 16, you can't really mold them anymore. You can be their friend. I mean, of course, if they live in your house, you can still say, hey, you live in my house. These are our house rules. It's not that you have to let them do whatever they please. It's because they're over 16. You can have a house rule. You can say, hey, if you live in the house and you're not paying rent, then you have to help out around the house and you're expected to follow regular principles. But that you might do for any tenant. Right? Anybody who's sitting. Direct instruction with people over the age. Do you like it when your parents give you direct instruction when you're an adult? Do you appreciate it? You may be externally respectful, but you don't appreciate it. I mean, maybe if you ask for it. Maybe. Even when we ask for direct instruction, we don't always appreciate it. Yes?
We are part of a Sangha, and we have about 15 kids in our Sangha. And we normally keep the kids in a separate room where we look after them. But our kids, when they get together, they mostly want to play. So we try to do some Krishna conscious activities, but the speaker of the Sangha generally prefers not to keep the kids while the Sangha is going on.
Yeah, most people won't tolerate that.
Yes. So, yeah, and we have 15 kids from age 2 until age 10. So it's a very wide range of age as well. We have tried, the speaker is one of the friends, so we have tried convincing him, we have tried a couple of times keeping the kids with us, but they whisper and they disturb the whole class.
Well, that means they're not properly trained. That's the parents. At least by age 5, you can train a child to sit quietly and listen to things. maybe not under 5, but definitely by age 5.
So they would not do an activity, but they would just listen?
I trained kids from the age of 5 to just listen to class. I never allowed any of my students to do activities during class, because Prabhupada didn't like anybody doing activities during class. Under 5, you could.
So would you suggest some ways to train them to listen to the class?
Aren't they trained to listen in school? Don't they go to school?
Yeah.
You're telling me that they sit in their science classes and just play games? I mean, it's not like some big secret thing. How do you train children to sit and listen to a class? I don't know, it's some kind of magic. It's done in school all the time. Now, it helps if the speaker is an interesting speaker. If the speaker is not an interesting speaker and is speaking way over the heads of the children, then maybe you should take them out and do something else with them.
It's a Bhagavatam Sangha, so basically...
It's pretty heavy.
Bhagavatam can be taught, so it's interesting for sure. You know, but if you can't do that, then you may want to take them out. I'm not saying the kids should never have anything separate. But they should also have meaningful service. You don't want to only have them doing something separate.
So then when you say that...
Now, if you do need to take them out because the speaker is just so absolutely boring and adult and over their head and speaking in, you know, PhD terminology, and the parents just refuse to train their children because they say they can't, what can you do? You can't force parents to change. So at least then, don't take it as a babysitting thing. But this is a totally different topic. But don't take the mood that, well, we're just trying to keep the kids out of the way and quiet so the adults can do something of benefit. But take it as an opportunity to really train the children themselves. And give them something that's really valuable for them during that time. I mean, best thing is if you could bring them into the class and the speaker is willing to give the classes also to them. And the children can be trained to listen to class. That would be the best thing. But the second best thing is have a program that really engages their mind and intelligence and emotions and creativity in something that's valuable, not just coloring pictures. Mm. As a babysitting thing. Anybody else?
Mataji, is serving for salon, would you consider that as a meaningful service?
What do you think? Is it?
I think it is.
Mm-hmm. So you have two things. You have things that don't require much skill, but that are meaningful and useful. And you have things that are meaningful and useful, and also where the children are learning some skill according to their propensity. So we shouldn't have the mood that, you know, I'm only going to do things that are according to my nature and I can never do anything meaningful. We don't want to train all the children to be kings and queens. I mean, if we had devotee kings and queens, that would be really cool, but that's not the whole, you know, we're not just trying to train the children that there's going to have servants that do everything they don't want to do. So to train them to do menial service for the devotees is very nice. At the same time, we would also like to train them in doing something that uses their propensities and develops their skills. It's not that that's the only thing they should do. They can also do menial service, they can also play, they can do so many things. But you want to include meaningful service. Why don't you include something where they're really learning something and they're really feeling, wow, I am contributing my unique talents and gifts to the betterment of others and for the glory of Krishna. You want them to have those sort of experiences. Not just that I'm putting rice on people.
Mataji, in terms of like encouraging children to chant, so out of these four techniques you say, what do you think would be most effective for them?
That depends on the person. But part of it is that relationship of love and trust. If the person that I love and trust is going to be happy if I chant, then I'm a lot more likely to chant. Because I'm going to want to do something that pleases them. If I'm exposed to stories of people who chant, then I'm going to be much more likely to chant than if all the stories I read and hear are people who don't chant.
I
I have positive emotional experiences in relationship to chanting, I'm going to be much more likely to chant than if I don't. If chanting is some kind of a chore or just some kind of a rule and I'm always being harassed about it. And this is true for us as adults too. I mean, a few years ago, I was actually in London. Somebody came to me and said, you know, I'm not finishing my 16 minutes. And I feel so bad about it, and I feel so guilty, you know, and I'm letting down my guru, and on and on. And she had all this guilt and self-hatred and self-condemnation wrapped up with her japa. Every time she thought about japa, and every time she chanted japa, all she was doing was hating herself. Do you understand what I'm saying? And I said, look, why don't you celebrate whatever japa you're chanting? Forget about the rounds you're not chanting. Right now, just celebrate the rounds you are chanting. Every time you chant one mantra, every time you chant one, you wow, chanted her. I talked to her like that for maybe 10 minutes. And then I said, just like today, how many rounds have you chanted today? She said, oh, I have 4 left. And I went, oh. she just didn't get it at all. But it was also like that for ourselves. We want to have positive emotional experiences ourselves in relationship with our chanting. We're like, oh man, I gotta chant. So many other things I want to do. All right. I'm such a terrible chanter. I'm just so inattentive. Hare Krishna. I don't have any love for Krishna. And that's why you don't chant anymore. You wonder why you don't chant anymore. Because you've just created this trigger between chanting and all this negativity. You know, everything about chanting, you're like... I'm such a failure at chanting, you know, and you just don't want to chant. So that's true even for an adult. So you want to try to, you know... I mean, it's hard, but at least you can have positivity around it as far as possible. Celebrate whatever chanting you're doing. Like when I travel with my grandkids, I don't insist that they chant japa at all. That's not one of my rules for them. They have to go to deity greeting, and they have to do 3 to 4 hours of service at the local temple again. Those are my basics. But, you know, they all bring bead bags and beads. They'll come and say, hey, guess what, Grandma? You know, I chanted 2 rounds today. I'm like, huh, that's great. What was it like? You know, where were you? Who were you with? And make it some positive experience.
In what condition would somebody use like a physical beat?
Well, Prabhupada said children should never be beaten. But sometimes he said something like, you know, he talked about Krishna putting us into distress. And he said that it's like a father may give a child a strong slap if they're misbehaving. That's how you know. Under what situations? I think that's too individual. It certainly should be something that's not done very often, and that it certainly should be within the realm of. It shouldn't be abusive. Mm. If it's rare. You know, thinking, growing up, my mother hit me once, and my father hit me twice. All 3 of those times, I definitely deserve to be hit. Definitely. Oh. So definitely, Prabhupada was not absolutely opposed to corporal punishment, especially from parents. He just wasn't. I mean, people want to say he was, but he wasn't. But he said children should never be beaten at all. I mean, he said if you beat a child, you should be hanged.
So to discipline, what kind of
things? That is another seminar.
Just any suggestions?
That is another seminar. Sorry, I'm not going to go there. In general, punishment is one of the least effective means of changing people's behavior. Any kind of punishment. It is not very effective. But Krishna uses it. So it's effective if used sparingly, rarely. Like yelling, you know, yelling is a kind of punishment too. You know, if you yell at your kids all the time about everything, they won't even hear it. You know, if you yell at your kids 3 times a year, then it will have an effect. If you yell at them all the time, they won't even know you're yelling at them. It'll just become background noise. It's true. Yeah, I mean, really? We were recently at the Brooklyn Temple, and the underground goes right under the building. You know, so every few minutes the whole building shakes. But if you live there, you don't notice it anymore. It's all the time. But if you're just visiting, you know, my granddaughter says, "Wow, Grandma, what was that?" Right? But the people live there, they're just nonchalantly going around their business. So if you punish children often, it doesn't mean anything. And you have to keep escalating the punishment to try to get some reaction out of them. And it destroys the love and trust. It just creates an atmosphere of fear. And punishment also creates an atmosphere where simply they try not to get caught. So rather than modifying their character, rather than modifying their behavior, they just become sneaky. You know, we do not change our character for people that we fear. So when you have dictatorships that try to rule through fear, they try to have the fear be around 24 hours a day. They try to have you be afraid of your neighbors, you know, who the secret police is. And they figure if they put you in a fearful atmosphere 24 hours a day, you're constantly be changing your habits, and then hopefully it will stick. But it doesn't. As soon as the dictator's out of power, then people immediately... You see this, even if it's generations, even if you have generations under communism, as soon as the dictatorship is... Oh, where's religion? Immediately. People just stop that behavior that they had done under fear. So getting people to do what you want them to do, I don't care how old they are, out of fear. It should be something. It should be for rare things. You know, running in the street when there's a car, and biting people. I mean, it should be for unusual things. It shouldn't be for ordinary things. Otherwise, it loses all of its effectiveness, and it damages relationships. So we have a seminar, 8 ways of changing people's behavior. Well, punishment is one. It works. Punishment works if it's used very judiciously, very rarely, and if it fits what went wrong. Certainly, punishment given just because you're angry and tired and you have a headache damages your relationship with your other. I think most parents do that sometimes just because we're human. You know, we're tired and our stomach hurts and we have a terrible day at work, and so we yell at our kids for something that normally we would tolerate. We are human. But if that's our general behavior, we're going to damage our relationship. Yeah.
You mentioned about children getting their values from TV, and so if they've already got that and stuck to one or two shows that make them...
It's tough, isn't it?
How do you devalue the condition?
Well, substitute Krishna conscious stories and stories that show people who are worth following. And I heard a devotee recently saying, you know, there's more value in the smallest bookstore than in anything that's ever been shown on TV. But I don't think that that's true. I think that you can find things in the media, in documentaries, in educational television. You can find historical stuff. You can find things that has value. And you can find, I don't know, you know, I'm really not up with all the, I'm sorry. But I feel in principle, I'm sure there's stuff there in the media that has value, at least on a moral and ethical level. And I know as a Gurukul principle, that I reviewed literally hundreds, or maybe it was even thousands, of books. And we had a system for reviewing books to see whether or not the book was of value. In our book, Vaikuntha Children, which you can get as a free download online, we would have how we would evaluate books. And I think the same is going to be true for the media. What's the qualities of the hero? What's the qualities of the villain? How is God portrayed? You know, is good rewarded and evil punished? Is there respect for authority? So we have all that in Vaikuntha Children. I think you could use that to evaluate also things in TV and movies and camera. I mean, there was a time when I just said to people, don't show your kids any media. And I think right now that is almost impossible.
Yeah.
Even if you got all media out of your home, which you wouldn't because you're using stuff for other purposes. But even if you got all media out of your home, they're going to have friends. What are you going to do, lock them in the house? You know, seriously, what are you going to do? It's just all over the place. That was not true 20 years ago. I mean, 20 years ago you had one box.
Sure.
You know, it was 30 years ago particularly. You had one box. You just unplugged the box. That was the end of your media. It's just not what's going on. I mean, some parents aren't going to be willing to take the trouble to do even that. What I don't know what to say. Then at least have a lot of Krishna conscious stories going on, at least in parallel. If you're not willing to take the trouble to review shows and review movies and pick ones that have some at least Sattvagun, or at least Rajagun, at least not Tamagun. At least get him up there to Rajagun. And if you're not willing to take the time to do that, then at least in parallel, lots and lots of Krishna conscious stories. I mean, at my son's house in Hawaii, we were able to fill two bookshelves completely with books that are in story form, Krishna conscious books that are in story form. And I think we could probably fill three bookshelves. Now that it should be a lot more than that. We should be able to fill three bookcases. But more and more is coming out all the time. All the books about Prabhupada life. There's devotees who've translated the Bhagavatam in just story form, just the verses. Stories about Madhvacharya, Mahabharata, Mayan that are in story form. Have those, read those with your kids, read them to your kids. Watch devotional movies, talk about devotional stories, I'd say at least once a day. For little kids, you have the songs. So at least add that to the mix. You know, if you're going to be giving your child junk candy, at least also give them a sweet potato, you know what I'm saying? At least also give them a salad. Have something healthy in the menu also if you can't get rid of the junk. And if you can get rid of the junk, then that's good. Some people, I mean, just practically, some people are not going to get rid of the junk. They're just not. They're going to give their kids a phone or a tablet and not going to monitor what they do with it. Because it's convenient. Which, by the way, is totally the mode of ignorance to do that. But it is what it is. I want to get my cooking done. I need to get my work done. And at least my kid's busy on the tablet or the phone reading what they're doing. I haven't a clue. That is definitely tamaguna on the part of the parents. But anyway, it happens. What to do? So at least add something, have something healthy on the plate. The best thing would be if you took the time and monitored and filtered, you can watch things with your kids and talk about it. I'm sure with all of the media available that there's things out there that are of value. There are things that will teach honesty and courage. Yes? Am I right? And loyalty. I'm sure there's still something out there that shows chaste relationships between people. Gotta be something still. It doesn't just show terrible violence. But be very careful. I mean, if your kid's watching things where people are regularly breaking the four regular principles in the show, and where they're disrespectful to authority, and they're disrespectful to each other, or they're lying and cheating and stealing, or they're, you know, killing and cutting up, what do you think that's going to do to your kid's lives? And just to say, well, it's convenient, and I don't have, you know, so I can be in the kitchen without being disturbed. I'm sorry. I don't mean to offend you. Very, very bottom. At least get some salad on the plate. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. if you're going to have diet Pepsi in your house, at least also serve salad. At least also serve some broccoli and some sweet potato. Have something healthy that's also preserved. But better to get the diet Pepsi out of your house. I mean, I became convinced as a miracle teacher that there is a lot of valuable, uplifting media out there. In books and magazines and movies and shows, I think that there is. I mean, there's a lot of just educational media. A lot. I mean, you couldn't watch all of it in a few lifetimes. Putting aside all the fiction stuff. You know, there's a lot on history and science and geography. Yeah, now some of that is also garbage. Some of that is propounding atheism. So, it's not just, the line isn't just fiction and nonfiction. Because in the Bhagavatam, we have fiction. We have the Puranjana stories fiction. But it's teaching truth. And if I just read about some movie star's seventh marriage, that's nonfiction, but it's not teaching truth. So just the fact that it's nonfiction doesn't mean it's teaching truth. And just the fact that it's fiction doesn't mean that it's teaching illusion. You can teach truth through fiction. Narada Muni does it. Bhaktisiddhanta does it. That Prabhupada does it. That's good enough for me. You know, if Narada Muni teaches truth through fiction. So it's not that all fiction is bad and all nonfiction is good. There are science shows that propound materialism and atheism. It takes a little discrimination. This means it takes a little time. You know, kids grow up very fast. And then you have a beautiful 20-year-old that you can look at and say, yeah. Very satisfying. It's very satisfying. To have, your adult children, and now I'm getting adult grandchildren. Who are people of character. People who have attachment to Krishna and people of character. And isn't that worth it? To take the time and what else is our time in trouble for? Is there some better use of our time in trouble than to explore what our kids are reading and what they're watching and discuss it with them, watch it with them, read it. Be part of their lives. Is that okay?
Thank you.
So I think now we have exhausted our time. If you want a seminar on discipline, we'll have to schedule that for another time.
Next time.
What are all the non-punishment ways of... You can punish your kids just, once every 5 years. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
I'd like to thank the audience from bottom of our hearts. This session was really, really